It was 2016 that one of our favorite guests, best-selling author Jeff Charlotte, was with us reporting on his personal experience of attending some Donald Trump campaign rallies. A keen observer and chronicler of human behavior and beliefs, Jeff once again waded into the sea of red hats and provocative oversized T-shirts earlier this year, just before the COVID-19 crisis overpowered America, and lived to tell about it. His reporting of the experience makes for spellbinding reading in the pages of Vanity Fair magazine under the headline, "He's the Chosen One to Run America. Inside the Cult of Trump, His Rallies Are Church, and He is the Gospel." Oh, Jeff, just in time for Independence Day, too. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. Well, and always good to be with you.
How many Trump re-election rallies were you able to attend before the COVID crisis and our botched response defeated our nation?
This time I only went to three, and I felt like I wanted a range. I went to Bossier City, Louisiana, which is outside of Shreveport, Hershey, Pennsylvania, the so-called sweetest place on earth, and Sunrise, Florida, and Broward County. And as I reported in 2016, when I also went traveling around to rallies, I wanted to see a sort of a spectrum of rallies. And then, of course, there's this whole world most of us are not a part of, where people watch these rallies over and over. They watch their favorite rallies streaming, and you can find them all on YouTube. And it's a little bit like Deadheads, Grateful Dead fans who have their favorite shows that they come to again and again, and they come to their favorite bits, their favorite songs, or in this case, their favorite moments of Trumpist violent rhetoric, and you play it again. And so that's what I was sort of interested in. What was the experience on the floor of the arena? And then what was the shape of the rhetoric and how it had changed since 2016?
Jeff, you paint a picture of a population that sees dark conspiracies around every corner and that fervently believes apocalyptic disaster is being kept at bay only by this sanctified president. What kind of campaign ad is ever going to break through that?
None. And, you know, I think the idea that we're going to somehow convince someone like, say, a woman I met in Sunrise, Florida, Diane, her name was, who was a devout QAnon believer in the QAnon web of conspiracy theories. She believes that the Democratic Party elite are actually cannibals and that they're eating children. And if you said, that's crazy, this is just an unhinged person. That's what I thought the first time I encountered that idea, maybe the second and the third. By the fourth and the fifth, I realized it's not the majority view, but it's widely present. And even those who don't subscribe to that extremist point of view say, well, I don't think that they're actually cannibals. They're trafficking children, sure. So, no, this is not something, this is not a campaign ad issue. This is not politics. It's why I say this is working much more along the veins that you and I understand as a religious appeal.
Is there any way to estimate how many in the president's base are the kind of devoted, mesmerized followers that you have met at the rallies?
I think that's the kind of quantifiable research that I'm not doing, where you really want a social scientist. What I will say is this. I mean, I was interested in what's going on at the rallies. And the rallies, of course, are a self-selected group. They are big. I should say this. A lot of liberals and lefties and secular folk think, oh, it's all just smoke and mirrors, or it's paid actors and so on. If these are paid actors, they're the best actors I've ever seen, and they all deserve an Oscar. The rallies I went to, as in 2016, were all filled to overflowing. 22,000 people in Broward County, which is a Democratic stronghold, and more outside. And so it's self-selected. I mean, and there's and it is true that there are people who travel from rally to rally, again, like Grateful Dead fans. A friend of mine called it the Hateful Dead, going from one to one. But what struck me was that I was hard-pressed as I wandered this arena to find someone who had the sort of the view, you know, maybe they're sort of like, well, I like Trump because I like tax cuts. And there didn't seem to be ordinary Republicans anymore. And in fact, booing the Republican Party is part of the ritual. Trump trots out the Clintons and you boo, and he trots out the Bush name and you boo. There is no party. It's a kind of, they feel they've transcended party. There's only Trump.
Yeah. Jeff, I find myself thinking that there are more than enough of them to take to the streets armed to the teeth were their leader to ever say, defend me, or my reelection was stolen, or one of any number of outlandish claims. None of them more outlandish than the kinds of beliefs you heard rally attendees willingly espouse to you. This is an enormous powder keg, as I see it, Jeff. Am I being too dramatic about that?
No, I don't think you are. I mean, look, we're at a moment when, as kind of moderate and centrist a figure as Joe Biden himself said, yeah, of course I'm concerned of what happens if I win the election, but Trump refuses to leave. You know, to think about that as mainstream, you know, political talking point, that's really astounding. And then to see it reflected on, again, talking to the rank and file believers, yeah, absolutely. There is no fair election that Trump could lose in their mind. And of course, Trump has doubled down on that. I followed the Vanity Fair piece up with a shorter piece, a sort of a close read of the Tulsa rally, in which he returned to the rally trail, which a lot of people read as a defeat. And there was a defeat. The fact that only 6,000 people showed up, that was good news. And we should be encouraged by that. The fact that 7 million watched it on TV, we should be concerned about. Mm-hmm. And what's really happening was there in that rally, I felt it was a turning point. He turned what some understood as incoherent, was a failure to recognize the working of Trump rhetoric, which he turned up to 11 in that rally. And there was a point at which he said, you know, the other side's very violent. Our people are not, unless they need to be. And then if they need to be, that will be a terrible day. And then he goes on, he says, on November 3rd, you're going to reelect me unless we do something stupid. And then you know what to do. You know what to do. He says it twice. So I don't think it's any, I hope that's not going to happen. I think there's a strong possibility we will just send him packing and get him out. But the prospect of real violence, well, it's not even out there. It's already happening. And all the so-called lone wolf attacks where, you know, you have individuals who have been mobilized and you see it at the rallies in which people are openly fantasizing about violence. This is how I think of the rallies, as they're essentially a ritual by which he stamps his name on the American dream and transforms it into a revenge fantasy. But that's what the American dream is. It's about crushing and hurting your enemies, and your enemies are everywhere.
Yeah, so well said. Jeff, the people you describe are archetypes and anachronisms, and it strikes me that they are profoundly American. The lore of the colonists and fur traders and gold chasers that nobody reads anymore is full of the kind of mysticism, superstition, and unfounded conviction that you describe finding at these rallies.
No, I think that's so well put. When you first said, you said the archetypes and anachronisms, and I was about to say, but Welton, they're Americans. And then you got there ahead of me and said it more eloquently than I could have. I think what was interesting to me was in 2016, when I went around to the rallies, the theology, as I understood what I was seeing, was really a kind of prosperity gospel, you know, which I think of, and, you know, as sort of a country cousin, right, to mainstream evangelicalism. And for listeners maybe not familiar with that, that's the sort of the late night televangelist saying, you know, send me $100 and God will bless you tenfold. And you know this is true because look at my private jet. So obviously I'm anointed, right? And that was sort of what God, that's sort of a lot of what Trump was offering in 2016. Now it's taken this darker turn toward what I think of as a kind of an American Gnostic gospel. And I'm not the first to sort of notice, as you say, that that kind of Gnosticism, this idea, this belief in secret meanings and layers of meanings and so on, that is an old part of the American story. That has been with us for a long time. I don't think I've ever seen a president harness it before and bring it from the fringe to the center. And I think that's really important for us to understand. There was a part where I was talking with this woman I mentioned, Diane, and I was wondering, you know, am I even going to be able to use this interview? Because it's so far out there. She was claiming that the horrible shooting in Las Vegas at the country music festival, where I think over 50 were killed, was part of a Saudi-led conspiracy to kill Trump. And I said, this is so far out there. And then I go home and I look it up on Google, and it turns out a U.S. congressman is proposing this idea on the Tucker Carlson show. I wrote my story for Vanity Fair, which is a big, slick, glossy with a big circulation. Tucker Carlson's got four times the audience. You and me here having this conversation, we're the fringe, unfortunately. Yeah. Those conspiracy theories that were once at the margins, the gold chasers and the trappers and so on, they have moved into the center.
A terrifying part of your reporting, really terrifying, is the utter demonization of the quote-unquote enemy. Democrats, Muslims, liberal lawmakers, progressive judges, and an endless list of other targets dehumanized and identified as a threat. No evidence is necessary when the leader insists, believe me, not your lying eyes. And allies can be created just as arbitrarily, Vladimir Putin at the top of that list. Where does that leave those of us who cling to reality?
In trouble. And especially you and me, Welton, who have a journalistic bent, because that, I think, what emerged for me from this round of rallies is there's all those enemies you talk about, although they can change and the allies can change. And people who complain about inconsistency are missing the point. The enemy is who Trump says is the enemy. The friend is who he says is a friend. Jeff Sessions is a friend one day. He's the enemy the next. That's fine. Yeah, don't believe me, right? And in fact, he says at all of his rallies, there's more than I can tell you. Let me tell you these dark, twisted things that are happening. For instance, in Hershey, Pennsylvania, that Democrats in Philadelphia are actually going through their jails looking for animals, that dehumanization, to release into the countryside. Now, implicitly, the animals, of course, are people of color. The countryside is white Americans. And there, they're going to, as he described, they're going to rape, they're going to decapitate, they're going to disembowel, they're going to carve with knives, they're going to eat hearts. I'm not being hyperbolic. That's his language, but played out much longer. The number one enemy, though, are not those actual human beings. It's the prop that's in the middle of the floor at every rally that agrees to serve as the heel in wrestling terms. It's the press cage. Most of the press goes into a metal cage, I like to just attend as a regular person. And there's a point, he says, look at those scum, those terrible people, those liars. And that's the biggest scream of the crowd. And I think what's happening is you need an enemy within. Every authoritarian needs an enemy within. And for that enemy within to really function and to really maintain the level of paranoia, they have to be able to pass. So Jews in Nazi Germany, communists in Cold War America, or for some elements of the Christian right at certain points, the gay man as a singular archetype, could be anybody. Your children's school teacher might be a gay man or a communist or a Jew. How can you say? Journalists now perform that function in a way that actually undocumented people and immigrants don't, because in the Trump imagination, they're the wrong color and they're easily identified. But a journalist, why? Welton, for all I know, you might be one yourself. Your own child could become one, and how would you know? That's, they're an invisible enemy within, and it's sort of drawing on the form and structure of the protocols of the elders of Zion. And that also has the added effect of, if you, anything you hear from anyone but me is suspect, I'm the only reliable source of information.
Jeff, one reason your reporting on these rallies is so valuable is the profound empathy you have for the disaffected and the disconnected. Your recent book, This Brilliant Darkness, was powerful proof of that. We talked about it on this show. So without asking you to play psychiatrist, do you have a sense that there is something, anything that might help fill the space in these zealots that is currently filled by Trump and Trumpism?
I do, actually. And I think we're seeing it right now, which is a real left, a genuine left, that is actually challenging power. I think of the very first man I met in Bossier City, Louisiana, an Iraq war vet, had been a UPS driver, saw 9/11, heard it on the radio, and got out of his truck and signed up. And then went over there and volunteered to do the work where you're, you know, you're disabling bombs in the road. Very, very dangerous work. Was horribly injured. Would said he would come home and he would on break and he would watch the news and it was all fake. Well, now he's at a Trump rally, so you know what he's thinking. He says, "Well, what do you mean? What would it real was?" He says, "Well, I knew what we were doing was we were just, it was blood for oil." He says, "We were clearing the way for Halliburton trucks, for oil trucks, and they said we were fighting for freedom and we were just killing Iraqis for no reason." That sounds to me like a person with a left critique, a critique of power. But where was he to go? Diane G, the woman at the center of the story with these very elaborate QAnon conspiracy theories, her moment of disillusionment came with her work with poor children through her religious, not through her church, but through her ministries, with poor children in Haiti. She saw what the Clintons, the work the Clintons did in Haiti. And she's not wrong in saying it was terrible. Even Bill Clinton says, we tried to apply a kind of free market American economic model and caused incredible damage. I think he called it, we ended up doing a deal with the devil. She lacked the structural terms to critique that. So she turned to the terms of her church. She couldn't talk about neoliberalism. She didn't know about laissez-faire capitalism, so she called it spiritual war. There was an absence of the critique of saying, hey, look, you're right. Something is wrong here. This is not the way it's supposed to be. But frankly, she looked at the Tweedledee and Tweedledum of the national parties. And there are real differences, but not enough. And Trumpism was able to sweep in and grab that up. Right now, I am a little bit encouraged, though, by the fact that we are seeing this real challenge to power in the streets and in the, what I hope will be a sustained demand for justice, for Black Lives Matter, for looking at not just tinkering at the edges, but asking real deep, profound questions about what kind of world we want to live in.
So this leads right into that. What do you want every American to understand about the people that you met at what you bluntly described as Trump worship services?
I want people to understand that they are, with as much empathy and sympathy for them and hope that some of them can see another way. Right now, they are real, they are dangerous, they are not talking about politics, they are talking about a kind of total war, something that I have said on this show in years past, talking with you. I said, I don't think fascism is possible in America. I was wrong. It's here. And the biggest thing that the liberals are making this mistake again, we just saw in the New York Times Frank Bruni had a column yesterday, Trump is toast. The 2020 election is already decided. Same headline we had in 2016.
Yeah.
Don't count him out. Don't count him out. This is a real movement. This is a struggle every bit of the way. And then the day after the election, no matter who wins, because whether Trump is here or not, the 200 judges he's put into power will remain. The generals he's elevated, all the agencies and departments he's remade in his image, many of those people will linger on. So that struggle is real. We are now going to be in a sustained struggle with the open and explicit prospect of an American fascism.
Jeff Charlotte is a best-selling author and writer whose essential book, The Family, was recently turned into a Netflix miniseries. Please make sure to read Jeff's Vanity Fair article, He's the Chosen One to Run America. Inside the cult of Trump, his rallies are church and he is the gospel. We'll link to it from stateofbelief.com. Jeff, it is almost unbearable to look directly at what we have become, but we must look at it and we must stare into it and think about what we're seeing. And for thanking you, I am thanking you for helping us do just that today on State of Belief Radio. Always great to be with you, man.
Thank you, Wilton. Likewise. Thank you.